front pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers, the latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Hello, it's Monday, April 29th, 2024, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Current and New York Times with me today is Lou Mirando. Let's begin by taking a look at the photos on the front page of the Hartford Current. There are, well, actually there are four pictures on the Hartford front page of the Current. Two of them are related. The primary photo, we're looking at what is called the Griffin Line. It's a railway, and we're looking down the tracks, and from one view, which is from the Sigourney Street Bridge. Then the next view we see is from the Garden Street area at Homestead Avenue, and I'll read the caption for you. It says, a view of the Griffin Line West from the Sigourney Street Bridge in Hartford, and another view of the Griffin Line from Garden Street at Homestead Avenue in Hartford. And we're going to be doing a story on that later on in the broadcast. The next photo, we're looking at an area in Wethersfield, and this has to do with a new river crossing route that they're proposing. And the caption reads, on the Wethersfield side, the new pedestrian and bike path over the Putnam Bridge begins at Great Meadow Road near an Interstate I-91 ramp. And we'll be doing a story on that also later on in the broadcast. And then the next photo is a headshot of a young lady who was 19 years old. She's got long, dark brown hair, and she's wearing a dark-colored either blouse or dress. And the caption in this case reads, Melanie Rieger, 19, of Waterbury, was murdered in 1994. Her ex-boyfriend, Jose Crespo, was convicted of murder in connection to her death. And basically, this man is seeking early release, and that's the gist of that story. Okay, let's move on to Lou now for photos on the front page of the New York Times.
Thank you. This is the these are the front page pictures on the New York Times for Monday, April 29th, 2024. The first big picture is that of Guatemalan military forces going through the hillsides of Guatemala looking for opium poppies. And this used to be a very big business in Guatemala for the farmers. And they made the opium, and then that was converted into heroin. Well, now that whole drug trade is shifting to the use of fentanyl, which is actually done in laboratories and almost anywhere. And right now, the farmers of Guatemala and other countries are finding a tremendous drop in their income because no one wants the opium poppies anymore. And we'll have a story on that later. And the next picture is that of the battered parts of Missouri and Oklahoma and Texas where the tornadoes went through this past weekend, and we'll have a story on that. This is just utter destruction of homes and buildings and businesses, and like I said, we'll have a story on that later. And then the third picture is that of a hillside of glass bottles and containers, and it regards the business that a group of college students in Louisiana started. Since there was no recycling of glass bottles in Louisiana, they decided to start their own business, and they basically collect the glass bottles now and grind them down into sand. And that is now a new creative business to preserve the waste that's being collected in Louisiana. And we'll have a story on that also. But now let's go back to Arlene for the lead story.
Pressure building for Israel-Hamas to reach deal. Biden-Netanyahu talk, some Israelis fear arrest warrants. This is out of Tel Aviv. U.S. President Joe Biden has again spoken with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the White House said Sunday, as pressure builds on Israel and Hamas to reach a deal that would free some Israeli hostages, and bring a ceasefire in the nearly seven-month war in Gaza. The White House said Biden reiterated his clear position as Israel plans to invade Gaza's southernmost city, Rafah, despite global concern for more than 1 million Palestinians sheltering there. In a development Sunday evening, Israeli officials increasingly believe that the International Criminal Court is preparing to issue arrest warrants for senior government officials on charges related to the conflict with Hamas, according to five Israeli and foreign officials. The Israeli and foreign officials also believe the court is weighing arrest warrants for leaders from Hamas. If the court proceeds, the Israeli officials could potentially be accused of preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip and pursuing an excessively harsh response to the Hamas-led October 7 attacks on Israel, according to two of the five officials, all of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to publicly discuss the matter. The Israeli officials, who are worried about the potential fallout from such a case, said they believe that Netanyahu is among those who might be arrested. It is not clear who might be charged from Hamas or what crimes would be cited. On the Rafah issue, the U.S. opposes the invasion on humanitarian grounds. Straining relationships between the allies, Israel is among the countries that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will visit as he returns to the Middle East on Monday after visiting China for several days. Biden also stressed in his call with Netanyahu that progress in delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza be sustained and enhanced, according to the statement. The call lasted just under an hour, and they agreed that the onus remains on Hamas to accept the latest offer in negotiations, according to a U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity because the official wasn't authorized to comment publicly. There was no comment from Netanyahu's office. A senior official, key intermediary Qatar, urged Israel and Hamas to show more commitment and more seriousness in negotiations.
Ukrainians say trauma lingers after captivity by Carlotta Gall and Orsolando Chuba, and this is out of Kiev, Ukraine. Ukrainian Marine infantryman endured 9 months of physical and psychological torture as a Russian prisoner of war, but was allotted only 3 months of rest and rehab before being ordered back to his unit. The infantryman, who asked to be identified only by his call sign, Smiley, returned to duty willingly, but it was only when he underwent intensive combat training in the following weeks that the depth and range of his injuries, both physiological and physical, began to surface. I started having flashbacks and nightmares, he said. I would only sleep for 2 hours and wake up with my sleeping bag soaking wet. He was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and referred for physiological care and is still receiving treatment. Ukraine is just beginning to understand the lasting effects of the traumas its prisoners of war experienced in Russian captivity, but has been failing to treat them properly and returning them to duty too early, say former prisoners, officials, and psychologists familiar with individual cases. Nearly 3,000 Ukrainian prisoners of war have been released from Russia in prisoner exchanges since the invasion in 2022. More than 10,000 more remain in Russian custody, some of whom have endured 2 years of conditions that a UN expert described as horrific. The Ukrainian government's rehabilitation program, which has usually involved 2 months in a sanitarium and a month at home, is inadequate, and the traumas suffered by Ukrainian prisoners are growing with the length and severity of the abuse they are being subjected to as the war drags on. Russia's torture of prisoners by war has been well documented by the UN, with former inmates speaking of relentless beatings, electric shocks, rape, sexual violence, and mock executions, so much so that one expert described it as systematic, state-endorsed policy. Many detainees also have reported lingering symptoms like blackouts and fainting spells, sending from repeated blows to the head that were severe enough to cause concussions. Ukraine's prosecutor general said in September that about 90% of Ukrainian prisoners of war have been subjected to torture, rape, threats, and sexual violence or other forms of ill treatment. Major Valerie Sobina, a military press officer and a former journalist who was also taken prisoner at Avolsta and who has spent a year in women's prisons in Russia, recently opened a meeting space in Kiev called Ukraine of Our Former Prisoners. There are many triggers and people do not realize they still need care. She returned to service 3 months after her release last April and found it hard to sit in an office. I cannot bear someone approaching me from behind or standing behind me. The government psychologists were not of much use. They often don't know how to help us, she said, and civilians offer careless questions. As a result, many former prisoners find returning to the front line easier than returning and rejoining civilian life, she said, and only fellow survivors really understand what they're going through. We don't want to feel pity, she said, because we are proud that we survived and we overcame this.
Protesters want amnesty as colleges taking action. Grades, graduation, and legal charges at stake in arrests. Marianne Alwan figured the worst was over after New York City police in riot gear arrested her and other protesters on the Columbia University campus, loaded them into buses, and held them in custody for hours. But the next evening, the college junior received an email from the university. Alwan and other students were being suspended after their arrest at the Gaza Solidarity Encampment, a tactic colleges across the country have deployed to calm growing campus protests against the Israel-Hamas war. The students' plight has become a central part of protest, with many campuses largely quiet Sunday. But students and a growing number of faculty are demanding their amnesty. At issue is whether universities and law enforcement will clear the charges and withhold other consequences, or whether the suspensions and legal records will follow students into their adult lives. Terms of the suspensions vary from campus to campus. At Columbia and Barnard College, Alwan and dozens more were arrested April 18th and promptly barred from campus and classes, unable to attend in person or virtually, and banned from dining halls. Questions about their academic futures remain. Will they be allowed to take final exams? What about financial aid? Graduation? Columbia says outcomes will be decided at disciplinary hearings, but Alwan says she has not been given a date. This feels very dystopian, said Alwan, a comparative literature and society major. What started at Columbia has turned into a nationwide showdown between students and administrators over anti-war protests and the limits of free speech. In the past 10 days, hundreds of students have been arrested, suspended, put on probation, or expelled from colleges, including Yale University, the University of Southern California, Vanderbilt University, and the University of Minnesota. Barnard, a women's liberal arts college at Columbia, suspended more than 50 students arrested April 18th and evicted them from campus housing, according to interviews with students and reporting from the Columbia Spectator campus newspaper, which obtained internal campus documents. On Friday, Barnard announced that it had reached agreements restoring campus access to nearly all of them. A statement from the college did not specify the number, but said all students who had their suspensions lifted have agreed to follow college rules and, in some cases, were put on probation. Columbia is still pushing to remove the tent encampment from the main lawn, where graduation is set to be hosted May 15th. The students have demanded that the school cut ties with Israel-linked companies and ensure amnesty for students and faculty arrested or disciplined in connection with the protests.
How fentanyl laid waste to Guatemala's time-worn trade in opium. The convoy rolled out of the military base before dawn into the mist-shrouded mountains straddling Guatemala's border with Mexico, its mission destroy opium poppies used to make heroin. Armed with rifles and machetes, the caravans, nearly 300 soldiers and police officers from elite counter-narcotics units, scaled steep hillsides and waded through bone-chilling streams. They chased leads from drone pilots and inhaled dust as they rode in the back of pickup trucks barreling down washboard dirt roads. but after scouring village after village, they found only tiny plots of poppies here and there, a fraction of the region's cultivation in previous years. The land here used to be covered in poppies, and now an area of remote hamlets populated by speakers of Mam, a Mayan language. But that was before opium prices plunged from $64 an ounce to about $9.60 an ounce. The largely fruitless search for opium poppies in Guatemala over the several days in March laid bare a seismic shift in Latin America's drug trade. In the United States, the world's largest market for illicit drugs, fentanyl, has largely displaced heroin because how cheaply and easily Mexican cartels can produce the synthetic opioid in makeshift labs using chemicals from China. Fentanyl is so potent that it can be smuggled in small quantities, hidden in vehicles, other advantages over opium, over heroin. As a result, demand for opium poppies has plunged. In Guatemala, poppy farmers are losing their primary income and what has been their only cash crop, forcing many in already poverty-stricken areas to migrate to the U.S. At the same time, local and international authorities fear that Guatemala could emerge as a new hub for trading in the chemicals used to make fentanyl. Guatemala's new president, Bernardo Arevalo, is strengthening U.S. ties in a bid to respond to the fentanyl trade. In ceremony in March, attended by American officials, his government said he was trying to improve ways to combat the trade in precursor chemicals in Guatemala, but such efforts mean little for villagers confronting fading demand for poppies on the one hand and eradication programs on the other. Poppies used to make a lot of people make ends meet, Mr. Garcia said. Now, he said, the steep decline in poppy prices inflicted so much economic pain that before the money runs out, people depart for the United States.
Parents forced to relive horror. Man who killed daughter in 1994 seeks early release. An upcoming sentence modification hearing that has two Connecticut parents reliving their worst nightmare as the man convicted of killing their daughter nearly 30 years ago is applying for an early release from prison just halfway through his 60-year sentence. It started on May 24, 1994, as Sam and Wanda Rieger were on vacation in Aruba when they got back to their hotel room and noticed a red light blinking on their answering machine. The Waterbury Police Department had called with news that would change their lives forever. Their 19-year-old daughter, Melanie, had been killed. While the parents were away, Melanie's ex-boyfriend, Jose Crespo, reportedly broke into their home, strangled their daughter, stuffed her into their son's hockey bag, and hid the body in a storage locker. After a traumatizing trial and subsequent appeals that tore open emotional wounds for Melanie's loved ones, Crespo had seemingly exhausted his legal options and was serving out the 60-year sentence handed down in 1996. His sentence meant the Riegers no longer had to see their daughter's killer in the courtroom day after day or relive the trauma of her killing by hearing gruesome details during court proceedings. For nearly 30 years, the parents, now 78 and 81, have worked through their grief, processed their trauma, and dedicated their lives to advocating for other survivors of homicide. They never go a day without thinking about Melanie, they said, but a notice they recently received sent them reeling back into the worst memories of 1994, only this time it came in the form of a letter. A few weeks ago, the Riegers opened their mail to find a notice that Crespo's case would soon return to court for a hearing to consider a request for a sentence modification. The request for a modification means, if it were granted, Crespo's sentence could be shortened and he could be released as early as this spring. Suddenly, all the intense fear, sorrow, paranoia, and anxiety the Riegers felt when Melanie died came rushing back. It takes you right back to day one, said Wanda Rieger. You just get all the same emotions all over again. It's horrible.
Okay.
It is now 19 minutes after the hour. Morning Front Pages for Monday, April 29, 2024, will return after our local and national weather forecast. National forecast. A multi-day severe weather event will continue today, with the threat shifting toward the central Gulf Coast as a storm makes slow progress to the east. Within this zone, thunderstorms may bring hail and damaging wind gusts to places from near the Texas-Louisiana border through Louisiana and into Alabama. Thunderstorms in association will extend to the north into parts of the Tennessee and Ohio valleys, as well as the eastern Great Lakes region, with showers from Illinois through the upper Midwest. The Northwest will remain active as well, with a chilly air mass filtering in behind a cold front that will bring showers to the region and even some areas of snow at higher elevations.
If you're a cancer survivor or caregiver to a cancer survivor, contact the National Federation of the Blind to learn more about the NFB Blind Cancer Survivors Division.
Now for our local forecast. Monday, very warm with periods of clouds and sun, high 79, low 54. Tuesday, cooler with variable cloudiness, high 65, low 50. Wednesday, showers around in the a.m., clouds breaking, high 63, low 50. Thursday, rather cloudy and warmer, high 72, low 52. And Friday, sun and areas of high clouds, nice and warm, high 78, low 52.
We resume Front Pages with Chris Radio for Monday, April 29th, 2024, in the New York Times. Dinner with Aunties by Alexandria Stevenson. Inside a canteen for seniors in downtown Shanghai, a worker brandishing a sponge inch closer to Maggie Zhu, 29, as she was finishing her rice and garlic and oil-soaked broccoli, Ms. Zhu ignored her. If you come at 12 o'clock, the aunties will give you less food, Ms. Zhu said, speaking softly. After 1:30, they give away soup. They also start to hover, like the auntie with the sponge, hurrying laggards out the door. Ms. Zhu is familiar with the rhythms of the Changzhou community's canteen because she eats there every day to save money. She has a good job as an accountant at a foreign firm, but she can't shake a creeping sense of unease about her future. Only when you save money will you feel safe, she said. In these tough economic times in China, many young people are jobless, but they aren't the only anxious ones. A devastating crash in the value of real estate, where many household wealth is tied up, has heightened the feeling among young working professionals like Ms. Zhu that her situation is precarious, too. In Shanghai, some people are finding relief in subsidized community centers that once served mostly seniors but are now also drawing younger crowds. The food is affordable and plentiful. The plates on offer, sometimes as cheap as $1.40, are crammed with local specialties like shredded eel with hot oil, steamed pork ribs, or braised pork belly. Yum, yum. Similar to soup kitchens, the canteens are privately run but subsidized by China's ruling Communist Party and cater to older residents who are too frail to cook or are homebound, offering discounted meals and delivery services. At the canteen, when Ms. Zhu likes to eat, diners who are 70 or older are given a 15% discount. The canteen is part of a three-story party community center that opened in May. As neighbors and workers from nearby shops and small offices pack into the canteen for lunch and dinner, collapsible dining tables and plastic chairs are quickly assembled, spilling out into the building entrance to accommodate grumbling bellies. During the lull between meals, older residents sit in the entrance, chatting and passing the time. A giant sickle and hammer ceiling light glows, reminding the diners of the landlord. The canteens date back to a dark time during Mao's general leap forward in the late 1950s when the Communist Party replaced private restaurants with communal canteens. Mismanagement of canteens played a role in the disastrous famine that would come to define the Great Leap Forward. Perhaps to some it may remind them of the tragic events of the Maoist communal canteens. I think for working people, Mr. Long said, the canteen is more affordable place to eat.
People flock to eat ice cream at this scenic farm. The ambiance is a big part of the experience, patron says. At Critz Farm Ice Cream, the surroundings are as yummy as the cones, shakes, floats, and banana splits. It's a place where people travel to from throughout Connecticut to eat ice cream and take in the wide open fields, big sky, working farm activity, draft horses in summer. Everybody says it's peaceful and relaxing here, said Wendy Chris, who co-owns the ice cream store on the farm with her husband, Timmy. I have some couples who come all the way from New Jersey because they love the environment. People come from far and wide to eat ice cream at the scenic Connecticut farm. A patron called the taste and ambiance a growing secret. The ice cream isn't made at the farm, as is the case at most ice cream shops, but is carefully chosen from area suppliers by Wendy Kritz. I tried the ice creams from all the suppliers, and it hasn't been good for my waistline, she said with a chuckle. Kritz Farm's ice cream has all the standard flavors, but also rotates specialties ice creams such as sea salt caramel truffle, peanut butter pie, toasted coconut, cannoli, and amaretto cherry. One customer called this year at the season start in early April to make sure they still carry blackberry lemon bar ice cream, confessing he has a problem and couldn't do without it, Wendy said. We have a lot of very popular specialty flavors that I change up, Wendy said. I try to keep it interesting. Guests rave online about the taste and ambiance, with one person referring to Kritz Farm in ice cream as a growing secret. One reviewer wrote that she loved the campfire s'mores flavor and commented, "Love this place. Last visit, I went after sunset and was greeted by a horse sticking its head over the fence. A pleasant surprise in the darkness." Another wrote that the ice cream was so amazing, smooth, and delicious. Timmy Kritz, a Faria and eighth generation farmer, runs the farm along with his son Faria, Cody, 31. Kritz Farm is located at 13 Bear Hill Road, Bethany, a town 20 minutes from Yale University and New Haven, 40 minutes from Hartford, 20 minutes from Waterbury, and full of hiking trails.
Credit scores don't reflect pay later. Shoppers in recent years have embraced buy now, pay later loans as an easy, interest-free way to purchase everything from sweaters to concert tickets. The loans typically are not reported on consumer credit reports, however, are reflected in their credit scores. That has stoked concerns that users might be taking on an outside amount of debt that is invisible to both lenders and financial regulators. So in February, when Apple announced it would start reporting loans made through its Apple Pay Later program into Experian, one of the three major credit bureaus, it looked like a watershed moment for fast-growing buy now, pay later category. But none of the major pay later providers have followed Apple's lead. And while credit bureaus and lenders say that they are interested in finding a way to work together, the gulf between the two sides remains wide, so much so that some pay later firms are exploring creating an alternative credit bureau to handle their loans. "I haven't seen really meaningful progress," said David Sykes, chief commercial officer of Kalarma, one of the biggest pay later firms. "Buy now, pay later loans allow consumers to pay for their purchases over time, even if 4 installments over 6 weeks, in interest free. They surged in popularity during the pandemic when they helped fuel an online shopping boom. The rapid growth has continued. The retail industry attributed its record-setting holiday sales in part to the popularity of pay later products. Delinquencies are pretty low. Job markets have been solid, so maybe that's not created the same urgency. Buy now, pay later has yet to have its real delinquency reckoning. People keep warning about it. Maybe that will ultimately be what spurs change here."
A spa for clients' heads plans adding a second spot. Business's long waiting list goal is sensory experience. Don't forget about the body, but there's a spa in Connecticut focused on pampering your head. The HeadSpark CT is one of few Connecticut head-focused herbal spas and is working to serve as a sensory escape. The specialized spa targets the scalp with a multi-process, customizable natural treatment that aims to engage the ears, nose, and uses touch to remove toxins and promote healing and relaxation. It uses aromatherapy, head massage, and what it calls a microscopic scalp analysis as part of the treatment. "We are a therapeutic spa that taps into healing people's scalps with natural herbs and products while stimulating their senses," said Jennifer Ortiz, the owner of the HeadSpark CT, who is a skin and scalp therapist and esthetician. "It can be as long as a two-hour experience that removes you from everyday life so that we can use the power of natural herbs and products to help treat your scalp and provide a sensory experience. Now, after being open for a little over a year in Berlin with an over two-month-long wait list, Ortiz will be opening a second The Head Spa on New Park Avenue in West Hartford. Instead of using prescriptions to heal scalp troubles, Ortiz's Head Spa uses skincare techniques and products inspired from Indian culture to treat a customer's scalp concerns and needs. This includes an Ayurveda silk serum mask said to promote their health and using rosemary and sandalwood to help fight thinning hair in the shampoo and condition treatments and weren't able to get their hair wet in the last 6 to 7 months, so we are able to help and remove that buildup and help their scalp, Ortiz said. We soothe and treat the scalp with different botanicals and natural remedies. Ortiz said the scalp is important and can often be underestimated. It is now 30 minutes after the hour. We will return with more Morning Front Pages for April 29th, 2024, after these messages.
Hi, I'm Tricia Beattie, a Chris Radio volunteer. If you need a ride to the store, a doctor's appointment, your job, or just to visit a friend, call Nutmeg Senior Rides. Nutmeg Senior Rides offers 24-hour service every day of the year to seniors and adults with visual impairment in Bloomfield, East Granby, East Windsor, Enfield, Granby, Summers, South Windsor, Suffield, Windsor, and Windsor Locks. This alternative transportation program uses a combination of volunteer and paid drivers who provide rides in private vehicles. There is no restriction on the purpose of a ride, and help is offered to carry packages, fold walkers, and open doors. That's why many feel that using Nutmeg Senior Rides is like riding with a friend. For more information, log on to nutmegseniorrides.org or call Margaret at 860-758-7833. That's 860-758-7833.
Crush 7 million pounds of glass that has been used in disaster relief sandbags, terrazzo flooring, landscaping, wetland restoration, and research. They offer curbside pickups in New Orleans and Baton Rouge and recently opened a small facility in Birmingham, Alabama. The company is poised to move to a new 3-acre site in St. Bernard Parish after raising $4.5 million to build out and equip the new location that they will rent. Glass Half Full's revenues last year were $1 million, according to Ms. Troutman, who said she venture was breaking even. Profitability in glass recycling depends on quality, proximity to a recycling facility, and how glass containers are collected. Glass is gathered with paper, plastic, and other recyclables, becomes contaminated and difficult to sort, driving down its value. So while glass can be endlessly recycled, it often isn't. The folks at Glass Half Full are doing yeoman's work down here. But he added the reason they have to exist was indicative of the broken system of waste management in this country. In many ways, Glass Half Full is testing whether it can solve a mismatch. About a third of glass thrown out in the U.S. is recyclable. While recycling rates in New Orleans are among the lowest in the country, at the same time, sand, which is crucial for construction, is in growing demand around the world. The U.N. has warned of looming shortages, but excavating sand is often environmentally damaging, and its weight makes it expensive to transport. In Louisiana, where wetlands have been vanishing at an average rate of a football field every 100 minutes, the state needs millions of cubic meters of material to rebuild its coast. Yet upriver dredging and damming of the Mississippi River keeps sediment that would otherwise be used for wetland restoration in faraway states too expensive to ship. Glass Half Full's operations are still small and its coastal restoration work is still largely in the research stage. But its founders say that pulverizing bottles in New Orleans and using the sand for local projects could help lessen the environmental damage and expense of dredging and shipping, while at the same time diverting glass from landfills. James Karst, the spokesman for the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana, a nonprofit group that has worked with Glass Half Full on several projects, pointed to the problems of coastal Louisiana faces. Sinking earth, rising sea levels, river levees, and natural wetlands long have carved out by logging and the fossil fuel industry. Our problems are tremendous here, and putting more sand into our coastal wetlands is not going to solve all our problems. Effective land restoration has to include reconnecting the river to wetlands, and he said in an effort currently underway. In an email, Ms. Troutman said the company didn't view its product as a panacea, but rather one small part of the solution to solving our coastal erosion crisis. She noted that the glass they recycled would otherwise end up in a landfill, and that, crucially, the company was getting local residents to help struggling wetlands. The more people we can get involved and passionate about this topic, the better we will be.
alleged hit and run stymies the student's life. University of Hartford sophomore had been planning to return to South Africa. Sequoia Hornsby was just a little over 2 weeks away from finishing her sophomore year at the University of Hartford and returning home to visit her family in South Africa when her summer plans took a drastic turn. On April 20th, Hornsby was riding an electric scooter, following behind her boyfriend on their way from the university campus to his apartment about 3 miles away, when they suddenly heard the sound of a vehicle that appeared to be going faster than the other cars on Albany Avenue shortly before 10 p.m. Without much time to react, Hornsby was hit in the torso, causing her body to spin around and leaving her head in a vulnerable position where it was struck by what appeared to be the mirror on the vehicle. I remember the impact of being hit and feeling like I was flying and a rolling sensation and being hit again by what we assume is the mirror, Hornsby said, but I was very alert for the whole time. Hornsby's boyfriend, Noah Carlson, was able to move out of the way with only the water bottle on his backpack being hit. He was able to pull his injured girlfriend out of the street to safety and call 911. I remember looking down and seeing my helmet hanging off around my neck, broken, Hornsby said. I was very aware that, oh no, how am I alive? I thought my head was in a lot worse shape than it was. I was aware of the pain in my ribs and the difficulty breathing and a severe pain in my arm, but I was very alert for all of that. I was more calm during the situation than I think I should have been. Afterwards is when the trauma really hit and I had a moment to absorb everything. Carlson said first responders were at the scene within a minute, tending to Hornsby and gathering facts. The vehicle involved a large box truck never stopped to make sure Hornsby was okay and kept going, she and Carlson allege. She was taken to an area hospital and treated for 3 fractured ribs, a bruised lung, and a hematoma to her head. I was surprised because I thought from the feeling of being hit that I should be dead, Hornsby said. I couldn't comprehend the fact that I was alive and had been hit. Carlson and Hornsby believe their injuries could have been a lot worse. They credit her metal laptop in her backpack with absorbing most of the blow and acting as a shield for her body. Thankfully, the couple said, she was wearing a helmet that was shattered on one side from the impact. It's a miracle, Carlson said. Thankfully, her backpack took most of the impact. Hornsby said her professors at the University of Hartford have been very understanding of the crash and have cut her slack with assignments coming in late as she recovers.
COVID class denied second chance at normal senior year. Dieka Jakarta imagined that she would spend her senior year of high school celebrating college acceptances with her friends, attending prom, and walking across the stage to graduation to the cheers of her family members. Instead, her senior spring arrived at the same time as the coronavirus pandemic. She said goodbye to high school classmates over Zoom. Her graduation was a drive-through. Ms. Jakarta, 21, thought her senior year at the University of Southern California might be kind of a do-over. But it has erupted into unrest in recent weeks after the school initially canceled commencement speeches by its valedictorian, Ashna Tabassan, the director of John EQ, and tennis star Billie Jean King, citing safety concerns related to the Islamic Hamas war, and then went a step further on Thursday, canceling the university's main stage commencement ceremony entirely. It's a very big hit for morale for the exact class that felt like they lost their high school graduation, she said. The student body president of USC said a few minutes after getting news that the commencement was off. We missed out on enough, but as was the case during COVID, Ms. Jakarta does not feel quite right about moping. It seems sort of ridiculous for us to complain about graduation when people's lives are on the line. It is a story that is playing out across the country. Millions of high schoolers had their senior years upended by COVID in 2020, being left to celebrate their momentous occasion for isolation. 4 years later, many of those same students have had the tradition of their senior years foiled once again, this time in response to the Israel-Hamas war and the attempts by universities to shut down or contain certain widespread protests. It was a real surreal moment when I think of the class of 2020, Miss Espinoza, an English major. I remember like a bunch of the BLM protests going on during the time, and now that I'm graduating in 2024, I can definitely see the parallels. Desmond Remington, also of Cal State, said that while he was excited to finally graduate, he was hoping to finish in a more low-key fashion. I was really looking forward to an easy couple of weeks before my whole family could be here and I could graduate and get on with my life. At USC, Mustafa Ali Khan had been looking forward to his graduation, especially after transferring there following 2 years of community college. One puts a lot of weight in these moments. It's kind of like a culmination of a lot of work you put in. He said the decision to cancel USC's main commitment cement would be especially painful for family members, many of whom had already made plans to come to campus. My mom's saying she can't wait for my grad school graduation now.
Study brings new hope for rail trail proposal. Findings may settle decades-old debate. A push to convert a desolate four-mile stretch of rail line into Connecticut Greenway with trails for pedestrians and bicyclists has run headlong into the state's stance that the rails remain a viable freight transportation corridor. But a new study shows for the first time that it is possible to combine the two uses in Hartford. A draft of a new study by the Capital Region Council of Governments, a regional planning agency, is breaking new ground in the decades-old debate over the long-term future of the state-owned Griffin Line. The study concludes that a trail system could safely and logistically run along one side of the active single-track rail line from Hartford's Asylum Hill neighborhood to the University of Hartford and the Bloomfield Town Line. The estimated construction cost could be between $30 and $39 million. CRCOG said the project would likely have to be heavily financed by federal transportation grants. The study comes as the future of the Griffin Line, built in the late 1800s and which some say reached its heyday in the 1920s, is again stirring debate. The Griffin Line is seen as a key component to the $65 million Heartline pedestrian and bicycling path that would run from Hartford's Riverside Park on the Connecticut River to Bloomfield. And it also is seen as a viable option for filling a crucial gap in Hartford in the East Coast Greenway, which runs from Florida to Maine. The Heartline is part of the expansive Hartford 400 vision for reconnecting Hartford to its riverfront by moving, burying, or capping highways. The iQuilt partnership, whose goal is to make Hartford a more walkable city, and the architect of the Hartford 400, has pushed for the rail line no longer to be used and the Heartline built next to or on the Griffin Line track. This doesn't preclude the Heartline vision from happening. Caitlin Palmer, CRCOG's Director of Regional Planning and Development, but it does allow it to start gaining momentum and become a recreational connection. Should the rail fall out of use, the study suggests that the trail can be expanded to include parks with more paths and amenities, or it could be used for a new spur for buses, an option that has been discussed in the past. CRCOG's study focused primarily on the feasibility of combining the trail and rail line, with the premise that the rail line would remain active at least for the foreseeable future.
Illegal pot shop gets a license, something New York said would not happen. A year after New York legalized marijuana for recreational use, a high bright green sign shaped like the plant's leaf signaled the arrival of a dispensary called Bodega on an industrial corner in Queens. The sleek shop, where customers purchase memberships for points that can be redeemed for weed, is one of the thousands of illegal dispensaries that the state vowed to shut down. Their owners would be banned from legal cannabis market, officials said. But instead, Bodega was awarded a retail license last month, the first confirmed instance of an illicit shop receiving one of the permits. The situation exposes lapses in the vetting process, undercutting New York's officials' assurances that those who jumped the line to cash on cannabis would not be rewarded over those who played by the rules. That said, they should be not happening, a licensee involved in the trademark dispute. He owns Bodega New York City, a clothing and lifestyle brand whose name is intended to use for his own dispensary. The Bodega situation has surfaced at the State Office of Cannabis Management, is under immense pressure from the governor and the industry to ramp up the pace of licensing and expand the legal market. It suggests that the agency, which is understaffed and has about 30 people assigned to review 7,000 applications, lacks the bandwidth to stop some bad actors from gaining the system. Bodega received the license, but it was not granted officially clearance to open. When reached by phone recently, Haley Velez Kibi, a Long Island woman who identified herself and city paperwork as the social club's owner, said she felt good about receiving a license and insisted that she and her co-owners had been following all the rules and regulations. It is unclear whether Bodega was on the radar of any of the authorities targeting illicit dispensaries. The manager said the shop had never been raided. It did not appear on the list of illicit operators that New York City was investigating. The Queens District Attorney Office denied to say whether it was aware of Bodega's presence. Even Mr. Clement said it was the shop that community board was at least worried about. Mr. Norman said Bodega might not have received the license if the state had taken a more aggressive approach on getting legal stores open and shutting the rogue competitors. Now, he said, they're out of control. Allowing these illicit shops basically stole New York's opening act because the average consumer had no idea of the difference, he said.
It is now 45 minutes after the hour. We will return with more morning front pages for April 29, 2024, after these messages.
Blinded veterans often find it frustrating when they try to secure the benefits they have earned. Such was the experience of Adam Fredmonsky, a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge and Korea, who became legally blind due to macular degeneration. When he sought additional disability benefits due to another condition, his request was denied. Fortunately, a field service representative of the Blinded Veterans Association intervened, and Fredmonsky received the compensation for which he was eligible. To learn more about how the association helps blinded veterans, visit bva.org. Connecticut knitter Joyce Kane lost her sight 15 years ago, but she still enjoys a good yarn thanks to audiobooks from the Library of Congress National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, NLS. The NLS collection includes thousands of fiction and nonfiction titles, including dozens on the art and business of crafting. To learn more, visit loc.gov/NLS or call 1-888-NLS-READ.
Well, welcome back to Chris Radio's Front Pages for Monday, April 29th, 2024. And from the New York Times comes the story, at least two dead in Oklahoma as nighttime tornadoes strike. Severe thunderstorms and high winds on Saturday night left at least four people dead in Oklahoma, including an infant, injured residents, and destroyed homes, the authorities said, as more than two dozen tornadoes were reported overnight. A series of tornadoes ripped through parts of the state, striking particularly hard the cities of Sulphur, Holdenville, and Ardmore, according to the Weather Service. Keeley Kane, the public affairs director for the Oklahoma Department of Emergency Management, said on Sunday that the state's medical examiner confirmed three storm-related fatalities, two in Holdenville and one on Interstate 34 near Marietta. At a news conference on Sunday, Governor Kevin Stitt of Oklahoma announced that a fourth person had died in Sulphur. At least 100 other people were injured across the state. Shelters and emergency kitchens had opened to house and feed displaced residents, while local officials coordinated search and rescue efforts, the department said. The man and infant girl were killed in Holdenville, the Hughes Department of Emergency Medical Service said on Sunday. At least 16 homes in Oklahoma were destroyed, the Federal Emergency Management Agency said in a briefing Sunday morning. On Sunday, Mr. Stitt issued a state emergency for 12 counties and third Sulphur. He described the scene there as just devastating, adding that it seemed like every business in downtown has been destroyed. He said that early reports suggested that a powerful tornado was kind of blowing right through the downtown area, and I just haven't seen this much destruction from my time as governor. Video and photos from television station KOCO News showed businesses in downtown Sulphur damaged or leveled and cars impaled by flying debris. Julie Jack, 64, who owns a woman's boutique in Sulphur, said on Sunday that her business is completely destroyed and all the contents are lost. She said that except for a new hotel in the downtown area where her new store was, I would have to say every downtown structure is lost. It looks like a bomb was set off. The severe weather came a day after tornadoes tore through parts of Nebraska and Iowa and leveled dozens of homes. In Iowa, 270 homes and multiple structures were damaged or destroyed in Pottawatomie County, and about 25 homes were damaged or destroyed in Shelby County. Nearly 1.9 million people in these three states, including a large section of Texas, faced an enhanced risk of severe weather on Sunday, with threats of wind damage, large hail, and some tornadoes, according to the Storm Prediction Center. The Weather Service said it had received more than 100 reports of tornadoes in at least five states in the Great Plains on Friday. Paul Enke, an elder at Harvest Alliance Church in Midian, Iowa, walked over splintered wood and debris on Saturday, looking for what he could be salvaged. "We were just trying to get stuff that can't be replaced," he said.
On the horizon, new river crossing route coming for walkers and cyclists. Cyclists and pedestrians will have a new route across the Connecticut River starting next month when the opening of the long-awaited multi-purpose trail along the Putnam Bridge creates a scenic connection between Wethersfield and Glastonbury. Contractors have completed the roughly 1.4-mile paved trail, and the State Transportation Department expects to open in mid-May. People are going to enjoy it. There probably won't be a deluge of people going to either town, but I think it will surprise some people how often it gets used, says Kevin T. Sullivan, co-founder of Bike Walk Wethersfield, a prominent advocacy group for cyclists and pedestrians. The project took 2 years and has spurred planners in both towns to look for ways to link established cycling routes to what is being called the Putnam Bridge Trail. Walkers and cyclists will be able to go from Great Meadow Road in Wethersfield to Naubuck Avenue in Glastonbury. The Putnam carries about 55,000 cars and trucks each day, but until now, non-motorized traffic had to take an 8-mile trip to the Charter Oak Bridge in Hartford to cross the river. Alternatives to the south required an even greater detour, 26 miles to the Aragone Bridge in Middletown and back, or else 11 miles to the seasonal Glastonbury Rocky Hill Ferry. The plan is for trail connections on the east side of the river to reach the Goodwin College trails in East Hartford, while on the west side, Wethersfield planners are putting together a temporary route to Main Street in Old Wethersfield. Eventually, the town plans a permanent dedicated trail for that, and Wethersfield officials are meeting in May to give a public update about the progress. Sullivan said recreational riders can do 10 to or 15-mile rides using connector route from the bridge trail, but said he anticipates that most of the use will be from people traveling locally. I've heard from quite a few people regionally who are excited about it, but I don't know if they're planning to ride it or they're just happy to have more trail connections, he said. My personal bet is that more people will be using it for everyday transportation. Wethersfield resident Joseph Seeker, who was out riding near the oil tanks along the river recently, said he's looking forward to the bridge route opening, but he questioned whether there will be enough routes to connect with after getting to the other side.
Welcome to St. George, Louisiana's city to be. Some are not smiling, though. The original plan was to start a school district. That didn't work, so a group of residents in a sprawling, unincorporated suburb of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, expanded their idea. Create a city of their own called St. George. In 2015, they collected signatures to bring their proposal up for a vote. They didn't get enough. In 2019, they tried again. This time, they made it to a ballot and won the election, only to be stalled by a lengthy court battle. But the Louisiana Supreme Court cleared the way on Friday for the formation of St. George, a city of nearly 100,000 that joins the ranks of the state's largest cities, falling between Lafayette and Lake Charles in population. It is the first city to be incorporated in Louisiana in nearly two decades. A majority of the justices found the lower courts had erred in blocking the city's creation over the concerns of its financial viability. This is the culmination of citizens exercising their constitutional rights. Andrew Murrell, a leader in the effort, now we begin the process of delivering on our promises of a better city. The city will consist of an area of East Baton Rouge Parish, which is run by a blended government that oversees both Baton Rouge and the broader parish. It also carves out a largely white and more affluent section of the parish southeast of Baton Rouge. The ruling signaled victory for a campaign that had endured since 2012 and was built on frustrations about schools, crime, infrastructure, and the resources devoted to that part of the parish. But its opponents, including parish leaders as well as powerful cross-section of business and civic leaders, contended that the complaints driving the campaign were unfounded and unfair. They argued that the plan for a new city was poorly conceived and would cause turbulence for the parish as a whole rather than improve anyone's quality of life. There is no basis, in fact, that the existence of St. George is positive or will bring positivity or have a positive impact on any areas of the city or the parish, said M.E. Cormier, who was a leader of the group that campaigned against St. George. Critics have said that the grievances were masking other motivations, describing the effort as an example of a wealthy white community trying to distance itself from the black and poorer residents of Baton Rouge. Some were disappointed that the challenge was now exhausted and believed that the parish residents who live outside St. George but would feel its impact should have had more of a say. Ms. Cormier, who's 39, said that St. George is an area that has transformed into her lifetime living in Baton Rouge. She remembered being the area where there was bustling with suburban homes and commerce, was filled with farmland and trees. That growth, she said, came from a parish's investment. There are legacy costs associated with that, she said. This is a bill that will be expected to pay, their citizens will be expected to pay, and it will be due and owing on day one.
Start planting now for a rosy summer. The warmer days of spring will soon be upon us, and it is time to think about spring rose care. Any winter protection such as mounded soil, mulch, leaves, or rose cones that were placed around grafted bushes should be removed. Release any stems that were tied for winter protection. Fertilize your plants when new growth sprouts with a complete fertilizer such as 5-10-10 or a natural organic equivalent at the rate recommended by a soil test, or follow the manufacturer's instructions on the package. Generally, the fertilizer is sprinkled around the base of the plant and gently worked into the top of the soil. Repeat blooming roses are heavy feeders and ideally should be fertilized monthly through July. Stop fertilizing at this time, as later fertilizations may result in tender new growth late in the season that may not have had time to harden off properly. Roses that bloom only once in June are usually only fertilized once in the spring. These include many ramblers and climbers, species roses and antique varieties. Rose books often recommend a dose of Epsom salts for each rose to supply magnesium. If you use a dolomitic limestone to modify the soil pH, however, the plants will most likely have enough magnesium available to them, and additional magnesium will not improve growth or branching. Note that according to the American Rose Society, roses prefer slightly acidic soil, so strive for a pH between 6.0 and 6.5. Most types of roses benefit from a spring pruning, with the exception of climbing roses, which are generally pruned immediately following flowering. Roses are pruned to improve their appearance, to remove diseased or dead wood, and to increase the quantity and quality of flowers. Polanthus, floribundus, and shrub roses do not require much pruning. Any canes that are damaged or broken should be removed, as well as canes that are rubbing together. If just the tip of the stem is winter killed, cut back to sound wood just above a healthy bud. Rose bushes that are really overgrown can have about one-third of their canes removed from the base. Hybrid teas and grandifloras usually require more severe pruning. After eliminating all dead and damaged wood, cut back to 18 to 24 inches. Make your pruning cuts at a slant slightly above a bud, preferably one oriented away from the center of the plant. How am I doing? If your roses are grafted, it is also important to remove any suckers arising from the rootstock. Spring is a great time to add a few more roses to your garden. Roses are soil, either bare root or as container plants. It is now 55 minutes after the hour. Let's look at our lottery numbers. Lottery for Sunday, April 28th. Play 3-day, 844 Wild Ball 4. Play 4-day, 0974 Wild Ball 1. Late lotto numbers were not available in time for this edition, so you'll need to go to current.com/lottery. Here are Saturday night's late numbers. Play 3-night, 071 Wild Ball 8. 3101 Wild Ball 9, Cash 5, 13, 17, 19, 30, and 32, Lucky for Life, 16, 22, 26, 31, 34, Lucky Ball 12, Powerball 9, 30, 53, 55, 62, Powerball 23, Power Play 3. Tuesday's estimated lotto jackpot, $2.5 million. Tuesday's estimated Mega Millions jackpot, $257 million. And tonight's estimated Powerball jackpot, $164 million. That's all for this edition of the morning front pages for April 29, 2024. We've been reading from today's Hartford Current and New York Times. Your readers have been Lou Mirando and Arlene Ford. If you missed any part of the program, it is repeated this evening at 6 and 11 and is available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening and have a great day.